They are yelling to have no more war. And there's a lady who's holding a girl with a baby has a little drip crying.
When he woke up from his dream, he stood by the window. The war was gazing at him.
Anybody who's even vaguely vulnerable in a health condition, such as a child or a pregnant woman, faces some immediate health consequences.
The Patriot Act powers are quite extraordinary, and we are not sure that they're not going to be abused.
We attacked a country that was defenseless, was known to be defenseless before we attacked.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, May 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Attackers shot their way into three Saudi Arabian housing compounds in synchronized strikes in the Saudi capital yesterday and then set off multiple suicide car bombs, killing 20 people, including seven Americans. According to the Associated Press, authorities also found nine charred bodies believed to be those of the attackers. The bombings, which took place about 11:30 p.m. yesterday, constituted one of the deadliest terror attacks on America since September 11, 2001. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the coordinated strike had the earmarks of al-Qaeda, the group that attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. President Bush denounced the bombings in Saudi Arabia as the work of, quote, killers whose faith is hate, and vowed that those responsible will learn the meaning of American justice. Bush said the ruthless murder of American citizens and other citizens reminds us that the war on terror continues. An Iraqi optometrist handpicked by the U.S. to fill in as health ministry chief has quit after refusing to denounce Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party government. Dr. Ali Shanan al-Janabi was the ministry's number three man under Saddam Hussein, and his appointment triggered protests by hundreds of doctors and pharmacists who marched last week to demand his removal. Stephen Browning, senior advisor to the health ministry from the U.S. Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, had earlier praised al-Janabi, describing him as a Ba'ath Party member who is not associated with criminal activities. But the health ministry, in a statement read today, said Browning had accepted al-Janabi's resignation due to his refusal to condemn the Ba'ath Party. It did not elaborate. Meanwhile, as Iraqis are growing accustomed to their newfound freedoms, Iraqi art, culture, and freedom of expression, which existed for many years as an underground forbidden subculture, is now returning in some parts of the country to its pre-Ba'athist eminence. From Baghdad, Raphael Kraft reports.
Every Friday morning, they gather in Al-Shabandar Cafe. It's at the very end of Mutanabe Street, the home of Baghdad's weekly book market. They're a group of friends made of painters, writers, sculptors, and journalists who gather to comment, talk, and debate on current cultural and political events. They come from a wide range of religious and ethnic backgrounds, but these differences matter little to the Iraqi intellectuals who gather in this cafe, since most of them are secular. Adnan, Nasser, Johanna, and the others have lived their entire intellectual lives underground. Haida is a sculptor.
Now everybody speaks freely here. Before, this cafe was filled with Iraqi intelligence and secret police. We couldn't talk the way we are talking now. Look how everybody is now expressing his own opinion freely. This makes a big difference.
While Johanna is trying to create a magazine dedicated to culture, Adnan is back as a theater critic in the newly printed communist newspaper. Bassem, Mohamed, and other painters have organized an exhibition of paintings. In the improvised exhibition hall, Bassem explains how painters were escaping censorship under the Saddam Hussein regime.
Many of these pieces are dealing with the abstract, because the realism choose a subject, deal with the party as a portrait of the leader. And so many artists go to work with abstract. We work not surely in the darkness. We work in our homes, and we put our thoughts and opinions about our life, but we use to deal with the stupidness of the party. They don't know what we paint and put.
Islamic calligraphy, pop art, Assyrian and Babylonian styles, the inspirations and influences are diverse. But the theme of war is seen on many of the paintings, as many of the artists were forced to join the army during the Iran-Iraq conflict. Nasser is the poet of the group.
When he woke up from his dream, He stood by the window. The war was gazing at him. When he's back from his sorrow, he was 40. It's a very short poem called Stealing or Robbery. It was published in a magazine, but the one word was changed. The word war changed to a quite different word, which is clouds, you know. Everything is different.
Every Monday they meet in Al Hewar Cafe Gallery and keep talking and drinking dark tea on a patio. In English, Hewar means dialogue or exchange. Yesterday afternoon, like many Monday afternoons, along with art and culture, the latest American-led war and its consequences were on the agenda. Many among them believe their condition under the Saddam Hussein regime has shaped their political beliefs. Nasser, who used to be a communist, is not anymore.
Globalization and the stream of democracy that is strong now in the whole world, something affected us so directly, you know. At last it was the war that changed the regime. So we were observing the world and trying to think how the things will come to us, you know. And at last you can see what happened. At last the USA decided to change by force.
The conversation heats up as their Palestinian friends join the debate. Zuhair was born in Baghdad, where his parents settled after fleeing British Mandate Palestine in 1948. He is a translator and a Fatah activist. What is this argument all about?
We believe that there is an occupation here in Iraq, and most of the Iraqis cannot see this face of the war. And maybe in 6 months, in 1 year, most of the Iraqis will see that part of the image.
But still, it seems that people can talk freely now today.
Yeah, freely, but it's upside-down freedom. They still drank of the throne of Saddam Hussein. When they wake up, they will see the real image of the occupation. As Palestinians, we know what the meaning of occupation.
Palestinians, as well as other Arab nationals in Iraq, have been benefiting from the largesse of the Saddam Hussein regime. They see the fall of the dictator with a different eye. Yohania is an Iraqi cinema critic. He was taking part in the debate.
Arabian countries suggest that Iraqi nationalism is something against the pan-Arab idea. This is not true, because Saddam Hussein and his people carried the pan-Arab idea only as a decoy to control the Iraqi contradictions. They were taking Palestine as something to rule Iraq, but in fact, all the time they were killing the Iraqi people. They were torturing Iraqi minorities, Iraqi ethnic groups, Iraqi religion groups. So we cannot talk about pan-Arab idea and forgetting what really is going on in Iraq.
Their opinion on the attitude, non-Iraqi Arab writers, artists and journalists in the Arab world is no different. They accuse them of siding with the Saddam Hussein regime for their own ideological and financial interests. So what do they think of the pacifists around the world? Yuhania met with the Human Shields in Baghdad.
I loved their intention, but they should extend their slogans to denounce Saddam also. They should also think not only of wars, they should think also of dictatorship, of the torture many people is suffering from it in the Arabic and Muslim world. And before they talk about the war, they should try to kick the ass of those leaders who will bring us to war. And the problem, many of those leaders are in our region.
Adnan, the oldest and also one of the communists of the group, reminds the audience of Saddam Hussein's brutal treatment of the dissident left. After the Ba'ath Party took power, Saddam Hussein executed 200 of Adnan's comrades in sequence live on Iraqi national television. He puts an end to the debate.
Sometimes we make some jokes as Iraqi people.
عندنا إمكانية أن نتعامل مع الشيطان ولا صدام حسين.
That we can deal with the devil, but not Saddam Hussein.
Asked about their future in Iraq, they say they don't know and they don't care yet. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Baghdad.
Well, as new leadership takes position in the U.S.-led reconstruction of Iraq, basic services like power and water are still unavailable in many areas of the country. In the meantime, humanitarian relief organizations like Mercy Corps are drawing on their long-established presence in the region in order to provide immediate assistance. In April, Mercy Corps received the 2003 Gabriel Gibran Spirit of Humanitarian Award from the Arab American Foundation for its work providing aid and contributing to cross-cultural understanding. KPFT volunteer reporter Seema Jalani spoke with a Mercy Corps aid worker who recently returned from Iraq about her work and the current situation in the war-ravaged country. She filed this report.
The war-ravaged country of Iraq is now facing a humanitarian and environmental crisis due to the lack of electricity, sanitation, and basic medical supplies. The World Health Organization has expressed concern about a looming cholera epidemic in southern Iraq, particularly in Basra and Nasiriya, because of raw sewage seeping into water sanitation plants and because of the massive destruction of Iraqi infrastructure. While cholera is usually easily treatable, medicines in Iraq are in severe shortage due to 12 years of brutal, debilitating sanctions and recent lootings after the bombings. The current cholera outbreak is being blamed on disruption and damage to the water supplies. Approximately 80% of patients currently seen in Iraq are suffering from some type of water infection. In addition, because of the scarcity of medicines, even easily medicated long-term illnesses like diabetes can no longer be treated. Margaret Larson of Mercy Corps International, a humanitarian aid organization, has just returned from Iraq and described some of the major diseases she saw there.
Anybody who's even vaguely vulnerable in a health condition, such as a child or a pregnant woman, faces some immediate health consequences of poor sanitation, contaminated water, because if that isn't taken care of fairly quickly, then we know that that tends to not only begin, but then increase geometrically over a short period of time. We saw a number of cases of TB, black fever, which is a fairly endemic problem in that area, problems with war wounds, health concerns that were caused by other interruptions of medications for diabetes. There was a need for insulin, for example, other chronic health problems that are simply going untreated, and a lack of antibiotics. So people who, for example, had been wounded or had been burned were now having sepsis problems.
In addition, many of the peripheral casualties of the war need attention. For instance, some people are thought to have gone deaf from the mere sound of the explosions, and the psychological suffering of children still has not been attended to. Margaret Larson expands on this.
People who have indirectly been affected by the war as well, for example, people who have been burned by using kerosene for cooking because the regular cooking fuel was made unavailable by the conflict there.
The chaos and lawlessness in the aftermath of the war has led to increased security restrictions placed on relief agencies and a severe delay in the distribution of medical and food supplies. A Canadian Red Cross worker was killed in Baghdad this week, and Doctors Without Borders reports that two of its staff have been missing since April 2nd. These instances have caused major impediments to delivering humanitarian supplies due to increased security measures. Cassandra Nelson of Mercy Corps International has been in Iraq throughout the invasion and spoke to us from Kuwait City.
Mercy Corps, for instance, has had health kits that we've had here in Kuwait that had been designated to go up north to Mosul. In these kits, there was enough medicine to treat over 20,000 people for 3 months. These kits had to sit here in Kuwait for several weeks before we were able to get them on a flight up there.
Margaret Larson of Mercy Corps International.
There's a lot of paperwork that needs to be done. It's a 3 or 4 day process to get across the border and get the proper permissions and that kind of thing. What does that mean for people who've been needing medicine for the last 6 weeks?
Paul Bremer, a former United States ambassador and senior State Department official, will oversee all political and reconstruction efforts in Iraq. He is affiliated with neoconservatives and maintains very close friendship ties with United States Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld. After his retirement from the State Department, he also helped to run former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger's consulting firm, Kissinger Associates. Margaret Larson expresses concern about the long-term rehabilitation of Iraq.
Corps and other agencies have been pretty open about the fact that we would prefer that our programs be run with reporting lines through the State Department and through USAID. We have some concerns about the way this has all been handled just because it's very important to us to maintain our neutrality, our impartiality. The role of the Pentagon and the Defense Department is new and different to us.
This week, the United States has pushed the United Nations to ease the sanctions on Iraq, but has also proposed a phasing out of the oil for food program, which Iraq predominantly relies upon for the survival of its people. The proposal also called for a coalition with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in order to oversee the reconstruction of Iraq. Margaret Larson expands on the impact of sanctions and on our lasting commitment to Iraq, a country of 24 million people, over half of whom are children.
Whether you like the sanctions or you don't like the sanctions, the fact remains that they've limited the amount of food, clean water, medicine, humanitarian goods into the country. Population that was just kind of hanging on in terms of being dependent on food rations, not having adequate resources in terms of clean water or medication to begin with, and then you add a conflict and a power vacuum and a lack of civil authority on top of that, and it's pretty easy to see why things just fall apart fairly quickly. It's easy for us, I think, to avert our gaze and move on. And it might behoove us to remember that we've taken on a responsibility to the Iraqi people. Remember that we have an obligation there, as we do still in Afghanistan, and not to allow our attention to be diverted, but to see this through. It's, if not the best thing to do on a humanitarian level, which I believe it is also in our best interest to have security and stability in that region. That's not over just because the troops are coming home.
Margaret Larson also described some of the memorable scenes she witnessed in Iraq.
Children and families and their medical needs and the basic things in life that you and I take for granted. If we're sick, we go to the doctor. If we need medicine, we get it. We're seeing people who are, in some cases, in very desperate circumstances. I saw a four-year-old girl who had her right leg amputated as a result of her home being bombed. Her mother had been killed in that bombing, and she was not yet aware of that fact. A little boy whose left arm was damaged in a bombing and had a wound open to his bone. We saw a little boy who was not war wounded, but has been trying to get some treatment for a terrible medical condition that involves a tumor in his neck and has been growing for years. And his father stood outside the Marine compound every single day with his papers in hand trying to get someone to pay attention. It's just a matter of taking a look at individual people and saying, how would I feel, what would I think, what would I do if I were in that circumstance? And I don't think there's a person in the world who can't relate to desperation you would feel if your child were ill or wounded or in desperate need, and how much you would want somebody to respond to that.
Across the street, across the globe, this is Seema Jalani, KPFT, Houston.
The U.S. Senate yesterday rejected a proposal to rescind the sunset clause of the Patriot Act, thus paving the way for some provisions of the act to end. The Patriot Act was passed after the attacks of September 11, 2001, to fight terrorism, but critics have charged that its implementation has led to the erosion of civil liberties. The fear of terrorism has driven us to grant unprecedented powers to the U.S. Attorney General under the guise of protecting us on the homeland. That says David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and co-author of the book Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Government officials see constitutional rights as obstacles to getting their job done, he says, and they indiscriminately sweep very broadly, targeting people who are guilty only of being from a particular ethnic group. Cole asserts that the McCarthy era showed us that if we go along with the restriction of rights of others, our rights will eventually be at stake. Peace Watch spoke with Cole today about the Patriot Act, its application, and the proposed new Patriot Act II.
Senator Hatch had proposed getting rid of the sunset provision, which was a provision that said that within 5 years of the enactment of the Patriot Act, various provisions in it would go out of effect unless reenacted by Congress, and that was adopted for good reason. These powers are quite extraordinary, and we are not sure that they're not going to be abused, and so the compromise was, we'll give them to you for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, they expire unless we determine that they've been used appropriately and that they're necessary and that they should be reenacted.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the more egregious provisions of that Patriot Act. You mentioned the immigration clause. How does that affect average citizens, average American citizens?
Well, it doesn't affect average American citizens because it's an immigration clause. Mm-hmm. So by definition, it only affects immigrants. And I think, you know, I think in general, the government has struck the balance between liberty and security by targeting foreign nationals and depriving them of basic liberties in the name of our security, sort of saying you can have your cake and eat it too, you can have greater security, but you don't have to sacrifice your liberty. And so, for example, in the Patriot Act, it imposed guilt by association on foreign nationals, making them deportable for wholly innocent connections to any group that we call a terrorist group. It authorized the government to keep foreign nationals out of the country based on pure speech, and it gave the Attorney General the power to, simply by filing a certificate, a slip of paper, lock up any foreign national mm-hmm. that he says is a suspected terrorist without demonstrating that the person, in fact, is a terrorist or is dangerous or a flight risk. Mm-hmm. Other provisions give the government a much broader authority to conduct wiretaps and searches without probable cause of criminal activity, and those do extend to citizens. Mm. Still, other provisions give the government the power to obtain records from essentially any business or nonprofit that keeps records on people, including libraries and bookstores, if they just certify that the information is relevant to an investigation. You don't have to be the target of the investigation. You don't have to be suspected of anything, and yet your records can be obtained by the FBI from, you know, your local library, and the library is compelled to give those records over and not to inform you that your records have in fact been turned over.
Mm-hmm. And we spoke to one gentleman yesterday, Jason Halperin, who says that, you know, he was just going about, he and his roommate were going about having dinner at an Indian restaurant in New York.
Yeah.
And so it does, and the point is that even though it's, you know, targeted towards a certain group, the rest of us who are citizens are oftentimes indirectly impacted by some of these provisions that are supposed to be passed in the name of Homeland Security.
Right. No, absolutely. There's no question that measures targeted at foreign nationals do have effects on citizens. And in fact, I have a new book coming out in September called Enemy Aliens, which argues that almost, if you look at history, at every prior crisis, the government has introduced security measures targeted at foreign nationals, has argued that the threat is foreign, has reassured the citizens your rights aren't at stake, but inevitably government officials grow accustomed to these powers and seek to extend them to U.S. citizens. And so, for example, the McCarthy era, in which tens of thousands of U.S. citizens lost their jobs, had their reputations ruined, went to prison for their political associations, was simply an extension to U.S. citizens of tactics that were first deployed against foreign nationals in the Palmer raids in 1919 to 1920 in what's called the First Red Scare.
It seems like this whole business of protecting our homeland and our civil liberties at the same time puts us on a very slippery slope where we are at this particular point in time in history. We're even seeing where the Patriot Act is seeking to be, they're seeking to be a Patriot Act too, which might expand wiretapping. What can you tell us about that?
Patriot 2 is very, you know, if the Patriot Act was troubling, you haven't seen anything until you see Patriot 2. I mean, it takes off where Patriot Act 1 left off. It's called the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, and it's got some really very troubling provisions. It would authorize, for the first time in America, secret arrests, where the government can go out, pick someone up off the street, lock them up, and make that fact a secret from the public,
sort of
from
disappearing
family members,
people.
Essentially authorizing disappearances for the first time ever in our history. Another provision would...
Wait, who would be able to be disappeared under those circumstances?
Principally foreign nationals, but also U.S. citizens under certain circumstances. That is very troubling. You know, after September 11th, the government locked up a lot of people and refused to give out their names, but it had no legal authority for doing so, and thus far the courts have said it was violating the law by refusing to give out those names. It's always been a public fact when a person is arrested in America, but the Patriot II would change that.
Now, under what auspices would they be arrested, say a U.S. citizen?
Oh, well, as a material witness. They could be arrested as a material witness. They could be arrested as an enemy combatant. You know, they could be arrested as a suspect in some sort of a criminal investigation. Those are the auspices. Mm-hmm. Other provisions would give the Attorney General the power to deport any foreign national, including permanent residents, without showing that the person actually engaged in any kind of harmful or illegal conduct. All the Attorney General would have to say is that the person's presence here is inconsistent with our national security, foreign relations, or economic interests. And that standard, national security, foreign relations, or economic interest, is drawn from another existing law and has been determined by the courts to be not reviewable in court. The idea being, you know, the executive branch is just as good at saying what's consistent with our foreign relations as are the courts, and so the courts can't second-guess that. And therefore, you'd be giving the Attorney General unchecked authority to pick and choose any foreign national, in the, you know, the 20 million foreign nationals who live among us, and pick them up off the streets and deport them without any judicial review and without any showing that they actually did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And then to top it all off, there's a provision that would presumptively strip U.S. citizens, including native-born citizens, of their citizenship if they are found to have supported a group that we have labeled a terrorist organization. So now, you know, if the Patriot Act was titled Patriot Act in part to imply that those who opposed it were not patriotic, now we're going to go one huge step further and turn citizens who are associated with groups we don't like into non-citizens, and then, of course, they would be subject to all the immigration authorities that we apply to foreign nationals.
David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University in Washington and co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Tomorrow, we will continue our conversation with Professor Cole as we explore the effects of abuses by the FBI in the past and under the current Patriot Act. Cole also offers insights as to how a balance may be struck between national security and our civil liberties. With so much talk of liberating the Iraqi people, we offer this analysis of the assault on Iraq by the Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Stations KPFT and WBAI in New York.
The United States and our partners are acting together in a noble purpose. We're out to keep the peace, to make the world more peaceful. And we're going to free the people of Iraq from the clutches of Saddam Hussein and his murderous allies.
Our goal is to liberate the Iraqi people. As in Afghanistan, our objective in Iraq is conquest or colonization. To liberate the Iraqi people. To secure Iraq's oil fields and resources. To liberate the Iraqi people. To collect such intelligence as we can. To liberate the Iraqi people.
Be able to say to the Iraqi people, we were proud to fight for your freedom.
Our goal is to liberate the Iraqi people. As in Afghanistan, our objective in Iraq is conquest or colonization. To liberate the Iraqi people. To develop their country after decades of neglect. To liberate the Iraqi people. Our objective is to bring down Iraqis with weapons of mass destruction and establish a new government, one that respects the American forces and those of our coalition partners, and to choose their leaders to liberate the Iraqi people.
We refuse to leave the Iraqi people in slavery.
Our goal is to liberate the Iraqi people.
Arkan Daif. Liberate.
They're beginning to realize, I suspect, that the regime is history.
And Sahar Akil.
Liberate. Liberate.
All Americans hold you and your family.
Atta Hassin.
Liberated.
To liberate the Iraqi people.
Ahmad and Daha Hassan.
Liberated.
Of its diverse population.
Khalifa Abdul Muhammad.
Liberated.
Liberated. Liberated.
And the aspirations of all Iraqis to liberate.
Esa Hassim Naheem.
Liberated.
Liberated.
Which belong to the Iraqi people and which they will need.
Moin Ade. Liberated.
Know that we are proud of you.
Doha Hossein.
Liberated.
That we stand with you today.
Hana Shahid.
Liberated.
Liberated.
And last, to help the Iraqi
Subhi
people.
Subhi Salam.
Liberated.
Begin searching for a way to save themselves.
Shafa Wahid. Liberated. Liberated.
To liberate the Iraqi people.
Tana Saeed. Liberated. Shad Hassan. Liberated. Shahid Haddad. Liberated. Doha Hindawi. Liberated.
Liberated. Liberated. Liberated.
Hamza Sihayi.
Liberated.
Liberated. Ali Shaha.
Liberated.
Khamel Sharif.
Liberated.
Liberated. Saad Hassin.
Liberated.
Abed Shaib.
The Christmas Coup Comedy Players. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.